Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop, all the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
America, welcome to the Inside Scoop. The Bush administration has 7 months and 10 days. 7 months and 10 days. Actually, make that 9 days. 7 months and 9 days. What can they do in 7 months and 9 days? I've been thinking about this ever since the conversation I had with Bob Kincaid yesterday. I hope you had a chance to listen to that. We really did have a terrific hour of conversation on his show. And he really made me think about what the Bush administration has to do. The interesting thing is that I really believe that virtually everyone is already looking past Bush. The American people are, quite rightly, caught up in the presidential election and the excitement of Barack Obama. I don't think the Republicans are excited about John McCain, but they're grumbling and preparing to vote for him and more preparing to sully Obama in America's eyes. But everyone's looking past Bush. In Europe, in the Middle East, all around the world, people are talking about Obama. I want to give you some specifics about that later on in the program, referring to how the world looks at Obama as well as how Americans do, because it's still quite an interesting thing, and it would change our country, I think, in the world immeasurably. But in the meantime, the Bush administration has 7 months and 9 days. What can they do in 7 months and 9 days? Well, Bobby Kincaid thinks that they can bomb Iran, and I suppose they can. Whether they will or not, well, it's anybody's guess. It's not clear what's going to go on. But one of the things that I find so fascinating is the more I read about Iran, the more I realize that these are the most pro-American people in the Middle East outside of Israel. Outside of Israel, there is no country in the Middle East that thinks as highly of Americans as Iranians do. The Persians are our fans, and they hate their own government. So, of course, we don't have a problem with Iran. We have a problem with the Iranian government, as do the Persians. And I want to think about some creative ways to deal with that discrepancy. And also talk further about the things that Bob and I brought up about nuclear proliferation, because it's growing. Iran is setting up an arms race in the Middle East, one that really can't help anybody. And then there's the question of the 7 months and 9 days. Ever since Scott McClellan came and started telling us things that, heck, I and others have reported for years now, but I guess people believe it when Scott McClellan tells them, it seems that more and more evidence of illegality is coming up. And yet, you know what's going on. The Bush administration is simply running out the clock. Everyone is looking past this president to November, to January. That includes Democrats. That includes Republicans, that includes ordinary Americans, that includes, frankly, all of official Washington. Generally, by the time you get to a presidential election year in the month of June, not much gets done. It's all a matter of looking to the future. Dennis Kucinich might put forward an impeachment bill, and it will be swiftly tabled, just as any Republican idea is swiftly tabled. Everyone's looking to the future. But is this a mistake? Are we taking our eye off the ball? This is an administration that has done so much openly for the past few years. They've done it secretly, but the press has failed to report it. Indeed, even Scott McClellan, the press secretary, the former press secretary of George Bush, has called the press complicit enablers. I couldn't agree more. Complicit enablers. For all those that complain about the liberal Washington Post, the liberal New York Times, Neither of the nation's premier newspapers challenged George Bush about the lies he was giving us in Iraq. And we now know, well, Horn listeners have known for some time, but the general public now knows that the White House was selectively giving us information. Now, again, that comes as no surprise to anyone who listens to the Horn. But there are people out there that don't believe people like us, don't believe people like me, even though I worked in the government. And so they only listen to people like Scott McClellan. Here's what's so interesting. Scott McClellan is not being ignored by some people who really matter. He has said, for example, that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby and Chief of Staff Andy Card purposely lied to him about their involvement in treason, their involvement in leaking the name of a CIA agent, Valerie Plame Wilson. So John Conyers, House Judiciary Chairman, has ordered Scott McClellan to testify. Now that's around the corner, folks. That's happening on June 20th. It's a week from Friday. And unlike the other members of the Bush administration that refused to testify, even though they have no constitutional right, you cannot refuse to testify in the Bush administration. It's not like this is something that they're beyond the Constitution. Still, they refuse to testify, but Scott McClellan, he's willing to show. And what will he show on June 20th? Well, that in addition to obstructing justice, which is the same impeachable offense for which the House Judiciary Committee passed articles of impeachment on Richard Nixon. In addition to that, McClellan will talk about the fact that the White House was in a permanent campaign. Well, that's not really a surprise. I think we knew that. But that because they were in that permanent campaign, they couldn't cope with Hurricane Katrina, and they were busy lying about Iraq. In fact, he has now talked about in his book the fact that Bush has admitted to him that he authorized the selective release of classified information, both about Iraq and about Iran. So, good for Scott McClellan. He may just be cashing in. He may be someone who was willing to work for the evil ones when he could, and now he's working for us. But all right, I'm willing to listen to him. Like David Brock, some turncoats truly either find truth, find their country, or find cash, whatever it is. It's nice to see someone in the Bush administration telling the truth. And there's a lot going on that isn't discussed in the heat of the campaign. For example, have you been following the craziness, I guess, of Scott Block? Do you know who he is? The head of the Office of Special Counsel. This is the guy that's in charge of checking out Justice Department prosecutions. Now, this is a very important official. He was designed as a separate office, the Office of Special Counsel. You can even hear it in the name. When we got rid of the special prosecutor, we got rid of the whole statute that allowed people like Kenneth Starr to search for everything they could on Bill Clinton. They started this U.S. Office of Special Counsel to look into when politics are trumping the law. So, for example, Scott Block was looking into the prosecution of the Alabama governor, Don Siegelman, the guy who started to win the Democratic race until he had an indictment and trumped up charges that put him in jail. So Scott Block opened up a file to look into this and then ordered it closed immediately. You see, it wasn't really him that opened up the file. It was some people under him. And he found out about it and closed it immediately, saying that he hadn't authorized it. Only 7 career employees had authorized it. Well, more than 7, probably. 7 have already come out as saying they authorized the investigation into Siegelman, and Block closed it. As the 7 career employees wrote, quote, "Concerns are expressed that the Office of Special Counsel simply cannot close a file without conducting an investigation into these allegations." So, even the special office, the one that's supposed to oversee the president, the safeguard within the executive branch, isn't doing his job. And, of course, Block has been doing his best to stop a lot of things, including really all the Justice Department investigations. You may have heard of Bradley Schlossman. Remember him? He was the acting U.S. attorney in Missouri. He's the guy that got indictments of liberal activists for voter registration fraud 1 week before the 2006 election. How convenient. Great way to stop voters from registering. And that, of course, is against Justice Department policy, which says you can't do that. So there's lots that goes on in the quietness while everyone is focusing on Obama and Clinton and everybody else. The fascinating thing will be whether the Democrats decide to move on or not. I hope they don't. In my interview with John Conyers last month, he promised me that he was not going to move on, that in fact, with the support of a cooperative president, he could get lots of documents that he's being denied right now, the same documents that I insist that he should make Harriet Myers do the perp walk for, these same documents that Congress has an absolute right to have, and the administration, for the first time in American history, an administration was refusing to allow Congress to get its documents. So, I've been pushing Conyers to seek contempt. For all of you that support impeachment, as I do, remember that contempt should be a whole lot easier, right? In order to impeach a president or a vice president, you need to have documents. In order to get the documents, you need to use a subpoena. Congress has issued these subpoenas, and the president simply refuses to comply. That has never happened before in American history. So before you can even get impeachment, as I argued to John Conyers, you need to get contempt. And as he put it, I agree with you, Mark. I just don't have the votes. He told me if tens of thousands of people were to call their members of Congress, he might have the votes. In other words, the onus is on us. It's on us to push our elected representatives to make Congress do the right thing. Now, you could say he was just passing the buck, but you could also say he's being honest. He doesn't have the votes. Here's what I'm scared about. I said to John Conyers, how is it that Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton and Karl Rove and all of them can simply refuse to respond to your subpoenas? A subpoena is not a request for documents. A subpoena is an order for documents. It's kind of like when the police officer requests that you pull over to the side of the road while his sirens are blaring. It's not really a request at all. He said, well, we've gone to court to enforce our subpoenas. Well, first of all, that's the wrong way to go. Courts have no authority over congressional subpoenas, and I expect that's what the court will say. Congress issues its subpoenas. Congress is in charge of Congress. The Supreme Court isn't in charge of Congress. The Supreme Court is a separate branch of government. They can't intervene in a congressional subpoena. But he says they're going to the courts, and let's face it, the courts are not going to rule until long after this administration is gone. So will John Conyers pursue the war criminals in this administration after they're gone? He said he would. He promised me he would. But there are problems. Even if John Conyers keeps his word to me, and he's an honorable man, I hope and expect he will do that, the documents probably won't be there. One of the very important set of documents that have already been demanded under the Freedom of Information Act by subpoenas is White House emails. And guess what? They're missing. Even the updated files, the backup files, the disaster recovery files, the backups of the backups, they're all missing in a 3-month period in 2003 from February through May. What happened in February through May of 2003? Oh, I remember. We began a war. March 20th, 2003, we began a war. May 1st, 2003, George Bush appeared on a ship anchored outside of San Diego, facing the other way so you couldn't see the California shore, and declared mission accomplished. Major combat operations over. That was an interesting time period. It was a time period when the White House was selling the war. It's a time period when the White House was getting documents from our intelligence agencies, the same documents that Scott McClellan says didn't show a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, didn't show WMDs, and was selectively releasing them, as again, Scott McClellan has told us. But you know what? The emails are missing. This is against the law. Not one, but two separate federal statutes require that all presidential communications, including emails, including those involving senior White House aides, they have to be preserved for the historical record, if nothing else. And now we know that nothing is available from those 3 months, and that 500 days of emails, yes, 500, that's a year and a half of emails from 2003 to 2005, are missing for those days. So nothing for those 3 months, and missing emails for those 500 days. John Conyers, if you want to punish the president after he's gone, how are you going to do it based on no evidence? The fascinating thing about Richard Nixon and his removal from office, and please don't tell me he resigned. He would have been impeached if he hadn't. We all know that. Is that there was never any evidence, never, that Richard Nixon ordered the break-in at the Watergate headquarters. He may have. He may well have. But no one has said that. G. Gordon Liddy, ex-felon, current conservative talk radio host, someone who conservatives love because, you know, they just love those lawless people. Nothing like felons serving loved so much by the conservatives. Ollie North, great felon and an American hero. G. Gordon Liddy, great felon and American hero. Poor schlub robbing a liquor store. Well, he deserves the death penalty. But it was never proven that Richard Nixon ordered the Watergate break-in. What was proven? That Richard Nixon destroyed evidence. He obstructed justice. He erased 18 and a half minutes of White House tape. Think how much information is in 18 and a half minutes of audio tape. And now think how much information is in 500 days of emails. A year and a half worth of emails. Transcribe the famous 18 and a half minute gap, if you could, and you get what? 10 pages, maybe? Maybe? I think that's pushing it. I mean, I've seen transcripts of conversations that last a half hour that aren't 10 pages. But we'll say 10 pages. How many pages do you think 500 days of missing emails would be from every senior White House official and the President of the United States? Well, he doesn't use email. Plausible deniability. Thousands? Tens of thousands? Hundreds of thousands? Is it fair to say that at the very least, this administration has committed 1,000 times the crime that Richard Nixon has? Oh, I think that's a very low estimate. You know, the first thing, excuse me, when I worked in Congress, the very first project I was put on, you always remember your first project, and I remember mine as counsel to Congressman Barney Frank. My very first day, he showed me a statute that requires that administrations save documents for history. And it's a very important statute. In fact, it's the same statute that allows us to now know a lot of what happened during World War II, and indeed during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because what the statute basically says is anything 30 years old, anything 25 years old, there's slightly different standards, but basically anything 25 or 30 years old, you get. Because there are not too many spies and operations and so forth that existed back in the 1960s, 1970s, that still require secrecy. You can make them secret, but you have to jump through a lot of hoops to do it. And anything that's 12 years old, also from the presidential library, has to generally be exposed. And this president, George Bush, when he came into office, what was 12 years prior to his term in 2000, his term in January 20, 2001 that the Supreme Court chose him for? Why, it was the beginning of his father's term, January 20, 1989. And George Bush simply refused to follow that law, and I was sent to research exactly how he broke the law. And unfortunately, while it's a law, there are no penalties. There are many laws on the books that have no penalties, and people just assume the president will follow the law, and he didn't. Well, again, if we're going to punish the president after he leaves office and his whole administration, how are you going to do it without the records? There are millions of email records that are gone. I mean, even if you just aren't about punishing the war criminals, even if you just want a bit of history, historians are complaining. They'll never know what happened in the way that we know what happened minute by minute in the Cuban Missile Crisis or in World War II, for that matter. So now what's this administration doing? They're reclassifying the very documents that were released. Now, this is really an amazing thing. I want you to think about this, because other than in George Orwell's 1984, I can't think of an example in history where people take documents that are out before the public and reclassify them. Oh, I guess one can imagine a circumstance where, I don't know, 1,000 pages are brought to the public's light, and you find one page that has an agent on it, and you reclassify it quickly before anyone in the press has reported it. But that's not the way our world works. People get it on the internet. This stuff is already out there. For all those that complain about, oh, spies and, you know, press having classified material, they complained about Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and his classified material, which was released to him legally, showing Iraq and all the oil fields that we were going to divide it into. There are two people on trial, two AIPAC people on trial for, again, having information that was disclosed to them. We have disclosed all kinds of classified material, and now the president is seeking to reclassify it. He is literally taking information from the public, from historians, and taking it away from them. And you know what? Some of it dates back to World War II. For example, there was a secret plan by Nikita Khrushchev to wipe out Guantanamo Bay with nuclear-armed missiles in the event of a U.S. invasion of Cuba. This was in the 1960s. Now, that's interesting historically. It has zero relevance to today, these 1960s things, except for historians. I'm a lover of history. Well, this came out, was in the public eye for some 20 years, and now the administration is seeking to reclassify it. Think about that. 5.4 million pages of history have now been reclassified. I don't think Big Brother did that much. So what's happening? People are leaving the National Archives. They don't want to work there anymore. And what's interesting is that they speak fondly in the National Archives about Richard Nixon's administration. The same Richard Nixon that covered up the Watergate break-in was a champion of openness compared to the present administration, National Archive officials are saying. Under Nixon is when they got the access to most World War II records in accordance with the 30-year waiting period. So since Nixon, we've had these documents. 30 years later, the administration is reclassifying them. I'm not even sure what they're trying to hide. I think they just really, really like secrecy. So even when the 7 months and 9 days are up, I'm not sure we'll ever be able to prosecute these people. One of the things in McClellan's book also I need to mention is about Stephen Hadley. Now, Stephen Hadley is one of the quiet members of the Bush administration. He sort of stays in the background, much as do Rove and Cheney, frankly, but even more so than the two of them. And McClellan talked in his book how Hadley told him that it was he, not George Tenet, not the head of the CIA, it was he, Hadley, who made up the claim that Iraq had nuclear weapons programs. I blew it, McClellan is quoting Hadley as saying. Hadley says, I blew it. I think the only solution is for me to resign. Well, he didn't. And he wasn't fired. In fact, he seems to be quite successfully ensconced in the administration. I don't know if you saw the interview between John Stewart and Scott McClellan. And if you did, by the way, I'd be interested in your thoughts on it. You can call in at 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. It was fascinating to me to see the discussion back and forth where John Stewart is trying to get Scott McClellan to admit that this is an administration that intentionally lied to the American people. And I don't know what it is about that three-letter word, L-I-E, that made it so hard to escape from McClellan's lips. But McClellan admitted it was intentional. He admitted that any doubts they had about the war were not expressed to the American people intentionally, that any small tidbits of information that could support their agenda, whether or not they were believed, were put forward as if they were certain, as if they were true. McClellan admits all of this. He admits that they're selling the war. He admits that any doubters were either fired or not allowed to speak out. And yet he wouldn't use the word intentional lie. Now, you know, we've all seen those protesters. Bush lied, people died. And I guess some on the right, even some in the middle, laugh at the protesters at their simplistic phrase. But what four truer words are there? Bush lied, people died. It is a fact that the administration knew certain facts. It is a fact that they misled the country, that they purposely ignored facts that went against the war, purposely made up things they knew not to be true. That's in the Senate Intelligence Report. Don't ask me. Don't attribute it to Mark Levine. The Senate Intelligence Report finds that they made up things they knew were not true, and they intentionally sold them to the American people. Now, how is that not a lie? When you make up something you know is not true and you intentionally sell it to someone to get what you want, how is that not a lie? Remind me to ask that question to Mike Lane or any Republican next time I have them on my show. I'm going to. I want to know how that's not a lie. Scott McClellan danced all over the question until he finally sort of conceded that, well, they did sell some things they knew were not true. Remember how Republicans used to care about truth? Remember how they insisted that every single detail of Bill Clinton's sex life, we had a right to know? Everything from anatomy to sex acts to the specifics of where he put his cigar, all of that. It was absolutely necessary that the American people know. But lying to get us into war, leading to the deaths of 4,000 Americans so far, the wounding of 40,000 Americans so far, the murdering of hundreds of thousands, who knows, maybe millions, of Iraqis so far, the exile of millions of Iraqis so far. That's just not relevant. Secret energy commissions, torture, warrantless wiretapping, secret prisons, holding people without allowing them to have trials, fundamentally breaking every one of the Bill of Rights and lying about it. Simply lying about it. Things as simple as the Red Cross demanding to know where our prisoners of war were kept. And Don Rumsfeld lying to them. The last example I know of where a country lied to the Red Cross about where their prisoners were kept is the Nazis. Maybe not the best example for Don Rumsfeld to follow. So they have 7 months. 7 months and 9 days. And I don't know what will happen. What do you think will happen? Will they bomb Iran? Is that what's going to happen? Will they let Israel bomb Iran? Are they going to beef up the troops in Iraq? You know, the Iraqi people are now saying we shouldn't be there. They're refusing to sign on to our permanent bases. Damn democracy. How dare they insist that they have the right to control their own country? What's going to happen in 7 months and 9 days? They will do their best to keep their officials from talking to Congress, that's for sure. What do you think will happen? 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back with your phone calls and your own analysis, hopefully. Give me a call right after this.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, is out with a report on how state attorneys general have handled the mortgage foreclosure crisis. ACORN says that a handful of states, including Illinois, stand out for their A-plus efforts to protect people from predatory lending. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan says while state responses are important, the magnitude of this foreclosure crisis for working families demands a federal solution.
We really do need a comprehensive plan at the federal level, one that is going to combine funding for loan modifications on a massive scale with meaningful reforms of the mortgage lending industry. Many, many states that have taken decisive action and have committed substantial resources in response to the foreclosure crisis.
ACORN says in its report that it's pleased with progress that state attorneys general are making in trying to respond to the mortgage foreclosure crisis and to take steps to prevent it from happening again. Madigan says she and her colleagues will continue their work at the state level, but they're also looking to Washington for help.
We're closely watching the efforts of our elected officials in Washington as they work to pass a legislative package that will bolster our state-level efforts to help hardworking families hold on to the dream of home ownership.
The United Steelworkers and the Sierra Club are working toward a future of green jobs for America in the Blue-Green Alliance as we wrestle with finding a solution to global warming. Dave Foster is executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance and a former steelworkers official. He says the Labor Environmental Alliance is pursuing its Green Jobs for America campaign to help achieve a sustainable future, both for the environment and for jobs. Foster says the Blue-Green Alliance is working to create a 21st century New Deal for the global economy, just as the World War II generation created a New Deal for the national economy. To build a green future, Foster says, traditional unionized jobs from carpenters to sheet metal workers to steel workers will be needed. The United Auto Workers Union has decided to endorse Senator Barack Obama for president. In a statement released Tuesday, UAW President Ron Gettelfinger said that, quote, after a historic primary campaign which activated and mobilized millions of voters, our union is proud to endorse Senator Barack Obama. Gettelfinger said Obama has inspired our country with a positive vision for a better America and with concrete plans to turn that vision into reality. Here's today's economic report. Barack Obama says the economic suffering of working people is directly tied to trickle-down style economic policy supported by George W. Bush and John McCain. Obama wants a government infusion of $50 billion more into the economy, an extension of unemployment benefits, more rebate checks to taxpayers, and an end to the Bush tax breaks for the wealthy. McCain wants to keep the Bush tax cuts and the tax breaks for big oil, and he opposes any more government money being pumped into the ailing economy. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. So what will the administration do over the next 7 months and 9 days? Well, many are concerned about an attack on Iran. I know that some at the Horn are laying out odds, laying out bets on it. Oh, call me eternal optimist and disagree with me if you want. But I don't see the administration attacking Iran, at least not yet, because they haven't built it up enough yet. Andy Card said before the war in Iraq that he's got to sell a war. And, of course, he spent all of 2003 selling the war in Iraq. He said you can't sell it in summer. You got to sell a new war in September. And if they sell it in September or October, a lot of people will say, oh, right before the election, that's not fair. So Bob has said yesterday, well, There's always the month of December. There's always that 2.5 month period between Election Day and Inauguration Day. Would he really attack Iran then? I actually think it's more likely that the United States will give the green light for Israel to do an attack than that the U.S. will do an attack. And I don't know that an attack is the right way to go. For one reason, Iran and the Iranian people largely support the United States. I'll get to that in a bit. First of all, though, I want to be clear that I do think that nuclear proliferation is a problem. I don't agree with those that say it's not a problem, it's simply used for electricity. And the clearest example is Syria. I mean, here you have Syria. They developed a very, very secretive plutonium-producing nuclear reactor. We have independent nuclear experts who have told us. This is the Institute for Science and International Security, by the way, which is not an administration outfit, but an independent nuclear outfit. And they had in their report on the Syrian facility that the Syrians had false roofs and walls that alter the shape when viewed from above. That the report says that the Syrian engineers went to, quote, astonishing lengths to hide cooling and ventilation systems. And basically, the main building was small and shallow. There was a large underground chambers, dozens of meters in depth. So what's that? That's almost 300 feet that were large enough to house a nuclear reactor, a reserve water storage tank, pools for spent rods, all of it. And even the traditional water cooling towers were replaced with elaborate underground systems. Electrical lines were buried in trenches. And instead of using smokestack ventilation towers, they built it along the walls of the building with louver openings. Fascinating stuff, really. They were determined not to be caught. In fact, it seems that the only reason we know about the Syrian facility is because of spies on the ground. Inside information, human intelligence, the exact kind that we need more of to fight our war. Now, the UN, the IAEA is going to go to Syria. Very late, but they're going. They argue that they should have known about it earlier. But in any case, we'll see. We'll see if they find anything. Because the IAEA believed that most of the uranium enrichment wasn't occurring on the site. There are three other sites that they think are the source for the uranium, and those, so far, Syria hasn't agreed to let them see. This is broader than Syria. The problem is that virtually every nation in the Middle East now wants nuclear weapons. This is, again, what Bob and I talked about yesterday, and I've done some research on it. Morocco, I'm just going to go around the Mediterranean. Morocco has agreed to purchase French nuclear technology. I'm not particularly worried about Morocco. It's a relatively benevolent monarchy. But I don't really care to have them have nuclear weapons. Libya, remember Gaddafi? They had a clandestine nuclear program in 2003. They told us about it. We let them go. We let them off the hook. We took them off the list of terrorist nations, even though they had murdered Americans. France, selling them a reactor. Egypt, its head is Mubarak, a vicious dictator who happens to be our ally. A lot of unrest in Egypt. The people in Egypt hate their government as much as the Iranian people hate theirs. Egypt has a deal with Russia for its first nuclear reactor. Three others are planned. I know Egypt is our ally, but I don't want them having nuclear weapons. I don't trust them. Mubarak can easily be overthrown by groups like the Islamic Jihad, a terrorist organization, albeit one that Cindy Sheehan supports, but a long, long-standing terrorist organization. They're the people who killed Sadat. I don't want them in charge of an Egyptian nuclear reactor. Going around the Mediterranean, Bob mentioned Saudi Arabia seeking uranium enrichment. Absolutely. I don't want Saudi Arabia having nuclear power. Kuwait, our old ally Kuwait, remember them? They're seeking nuclear power. They say it's for domestic energy. United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, two little countries, oil-rich countries, seeking nuclear power. I've talked about Syria. Turkey bothers me less. Turkey is a democracy. It's a Muslim democracy, but it is a democracy. Turkey, I'm less concerned about. Still, three reactors. Developing it all because of Iran. Even if you think that Iran isn't such a problem, understand what Iran is doing to the region. There are international sanctions against Iran, saying it cannot expand its uranium enrichment program. Iran is outside those sanctions by the United Nations Security Council. Yes, it is true that we had a national intelligence estimate that Iran stopped work on designing a nuclear weapon in 2003. We don't know if it has changed its mind on that. But everyone agrees that designing a weapon is easy. The hard part is producing this enriched uranium, which they suspended in 2003, the same time they suspended a nuclear weapon, but they restarted in 2006. Now, the experts say, while it is possible that Iran could produce enough weapons-grade uranium, enriched uranium, by 2009, that is very unlikely. It probably could do so in the 2010 to 2015 time frame. So that answers Bob's question. He said about 10 years. The nuclear experts say it is possible by 2009, unlikely, very unlikely, to be fair, very unlikely by 2009, but probable sometime between 2010 and 2015. We assess with moderate to high confidence that Tehran, at a minimum, is keeping open the option to develop nuclear weapons. So there is an arms race. It's not just Iran, but it's being stoked by Iran. Even Yemen, the very poorest country in the Arab world, said that they're going to buy a nuclear reactor. As I said, Egypt's ambassador said that they kept out of it for a long time, but Egypt's ambassador to the United States, Nabil Fahmy, said, quote, a nuclear arms race is inevitable unless these weapons are banned. Now, the only two of those countries that have promised never to pursue uranium enrichment are the UAE and Bahrain, the two smallest countries. It takes decades to build a nuclear infrastructure. And it seems like they're saying if it's going to be an arms race, all of these countries, Morocco, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, we'll leave out UAE and Bahrain. But Turkey, Syria, and Iran are all getting there. Now, Iran's facility is at Natanz. It's mostly underground, I guess like mostly Syria's was. And they're now operating 3,000 centrifuges, plan to increase it to 50,000. IAEA officials, you remember them, they're the ones that wanted to go into Iraq. And they were allowed into Iraq, and we didn't allow them to do their job because they found no weapons of mass destruction, and we ignored them. Mohammed al-Baradei, UN official, these are good guys. They say they have never seen such widespread interest in starting domestic nuclear power at any time in world history. That includes poor African countries like Nigeria and Namibia, at least half a dozen Soviet republics. And they remind us that both India and Pakistan started their nuclear weapons, ostensibly for civilian purposes. Our allies, Taiwan and South Korea, also started nuclear weapons for civilian purposes. And started to convert them to military, and we stopped them because, hey, they're our allies. South Korea and Taiwan, hey, I mean, they at least would have some reason to have nuclear power. They, like Israel, face a threat to their existential existence. So it is a problem. I don't want to say it's not a problem. It is a problem. What are we to do about it? Well, I think one thing to do about it is to look at where the Iranian people lie. To understand very clearly that our beef is not with the people of Iran. That's very, very important. Because, let's face it, Al-Qaeda is getting a lot of support from terrorists all across the globe who believe in jihad. Radical Islamic people who have seen the terrible things the United States has done, invading a country that never attacked us and so forth, and, yes, want to commit terrorist acts. This is not true of the great majority of the people in Iran. I want to read to you from a fascinating article called Stars and Stripes in Their Eyes by Azadeh Movanish. Now, she covers Iran for Time magazine. She is an Iranian. She's not at all pro-Bush. But she simply describes what it's like in Iran right now. And I talked about this article before. It's really a great article. In fact, I think I'll link to it from my website so you all can read it. The caption under, the main caption of the article is, "Most of the Middle East hates America, but Iranians see a more appealing image. It's their own president they can't stand." She begins the article by saying that she was on a rickety bus on Tehran's main thoroughfare, and she overheard two women talking. One of them said, quote, "Let the Americans come." She said this really loudly in the bush, in the bus. Excuse me. "Let the Americans come. Let them sort things out for us once and for all." She writes, "Everyone in the women's section of the bus absorbed this casually," and her friend nodded in assent. She talks about the fact that it wasn't always like this, that in 2005, just 3 years ago, there was a very strong, she put it, as ambivalence toward the United States, that the attacks on Iraq and Afghanistan rattled ordinary Iranians, scared them, it added to their national pride, it added to their resentment, and that in 06, when she was there, she heard lots of people complain about the United States. And they were proud of their president, standing up to the United States like a man. What a difference 2 years make. The fascinating thing is they don't like the United States for anything we've done, but because they hate their own government so much. 2 years ago, they replaced Valentine's Day with Armati Day, which is a love festival for a Persian deity. But this year, Valentine's Day was back. They have a burger chain that's modeled after Carl Jr. And a poll found, listen to this, a poll found that 74% of Iranians support restoring ties with the United States. The pollster was sent to prison. "You couldn't attend a dinner party," she writes, "without hearing someone envious of the Afghans say, 'When will the Americans come save us?'" Now, none of this is love of Bush. None of this is support for our war in Iraq or Afghanistan. So much as it is that they don't like their own leaders. And they understand that we don't like their leaders either. Inflation is at least 20%. Real estate prices are up 150%. The country has tremendous oil wealth, and it's all going to a few corrupt Iranians. And they've got the BMWs and the Mercedes-Benzes. And the government regulates the price of bread. But they don't regulate the size of loaves of bread. So loaves of bread are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. She quotes Ali Ghassemi, a 34-year-old graphic designer who was struggling, talked proudly about the financial success of a cousin in Orange County, California. Quote, "You can compete in the United States because it has a much fairer legal system than most countries," unquote. There's gas rationing because Ahmadinejad is worried about sanctions. And there are raids on office buildings to ensure women wear proper Islamic dress. Now, Iranian women, much like, I should say, Iraqi women, but even more so, are extremely modern people. This is not, Bedouin women that are shepherding goats around, as some would have image of some. These are, the Shah was very fair to women. He was terrible to people who tried to oppose him. He tortured his political opponents. But women had equal rights under the Shah. And many don't want to wear Islamic dress. So they have little codes that warn them when they're going to come in and make them wear Islamic dresses. And they have another problem in that the police are constantly confiscating their satellite dishes. Now, some of these satellite dishes are used to get world news. And some of it is just to see American Idol. They love American culture. And the most interesting thing is that they are against Ahmadinejad's nuclear program. Ahmadinejad, 2 years ago, when he was much more popular, had catchy slogans. There was a rhyming one in the Iranian language of Farsi that says, "Nuclear energy is our absolute right." But all it did was make Iran into a pariah. Now there's graffiti on the street that says, "Danish pastry is our absolute right." You see, just as we called French fries freedom fries, Ahmadinejad insisted that Danish pastry be called freedom pastry or some other non-Danish word because you may recall Danish newspapers had cartoons about Muhammad. So Danish pastry became Persian pastry. This author, who is, as I say, a reporter for Time magazine, is an Iranian. She believes that only 10% of the society still hate America, still support Ahmadinejad. She points out that in Iran, you don't have the feeling of some Arabs and Muslims, particularly Arabs, for Palestinians. You don't find the hatred of Israel that you find in the Arab world, that many remember the Shah and are nostalgic for the Shah's era. Yeah, he was a dictator, but he did a lot better for Iran than subsequent dictators. And most all of them love Barack Obama. They really feel like Barack Obama will patch up relations with Iran. Before the revolution, as one young man said, who was selling DVDs of American films and bootleg series, he said, quote, "Before the revolution, we had relations with the United States. Was that bad for us? We were at the top of the world." Why do I give you all this data? I give you all this data to emphasize that there are ways out of the Iranian nuclear problem without an attack. I am not going to say it's not a problem. I disagree with some of my colleagues here. I do not think that it is not a problem. It is a problem. It is a problem that Iran is building these weapons. It's a problem because you've got 10 other countries in the Middle East that want to build these weapons because they're afraid of Iran. But it is a fixable problem. It would take a president of enormous charisma, perhaps a president whose very skin color shows that he's not a typical American, perhaps one who has an ancestor from Africa. Perhaps it takes an American president to go to Iran and talk publicly, not to Khamenei, not to Ahmadinejad, he can talk to them as well, but to talk over their heads. If Obama's smart, and I think he's very smart, he needs to insist that, yeah, I'll talk with you, Iranian government, on condition that you let me give a speech uncensored on press TV, on the Iranian television channel. Or not just that, because press TV is mostly an international channel. I know, I used to host a show there. But on the Iranian channels, translated into Farsi, with us looking at the translation to make sure it's accurate. Think about that. Here you have a public that sounds like it's 74% pro-American, 10% anti-American, and I don't know, maybe 15% undecided. And here we have a young, charismatic American president making clear that we reach out to the people of Iran, that we want to help you. We don't want you to be a pariah. We want to trade with you. We want to bring you back to the freedoms you've had. Iran is very different from Iraq and from Syria and even from Saudi Arabia. The dictators are not quite in the same control as they are in North Korea or they were in Afghanistan. This is not a totalitarian society. Talk to any Iranian, you'll find out. Iraq was totalitarian. North Korea is extremely totalitarian. You can't speak a word against the government without secret police rounding you up and taking you away. It's not like that in Iran. As this article points out, you can freely criticize the government, and people do it all the time. You can't elect a new government, but you can still criticize the government. There is so much dislike of the current government in Iran that they can't contain it all. So the right president saying the right words, I so many people are pessimistic. Oh, we're either going to let Iran have nuclear weapons, just ignore it, it's not a problem, and if you let Iran have nuclear weapons, then I'm sorry, you got to include Egypt and Libya and all the other dictatorships of the Middle East. Or, they say, as the neocons do, let's bomb Iran, let's invade Iran, let's take over Iran. Not smart. We couldn't do it if we wanted to. We don't have the troops. Not to mention the hatred for America. I believe there is a middle position. And the middle position is to reach out to the very people of Iran that love America in spite of Bush. Think about it. 74% want relations with America in spite of Bush. How much more would they love Obama? Obama would be treated like cheering, like people treat the Pope in Latin American countries. We'd have to make sure he's protected, obviously. But there is a real chance for diplomacy here, precisely because Iran is not a complete totalitarian government yet. It's not a complete police state yet. It's not, frankly, as much of a police state as Saddam Hussein was. It is stronger than Iraq, but not as consolidated. The people of Iran just 4 years ago elected Khatami, a moderate guy. Now, they elected him. He wasn't given any power by the mullahs, and the mullahs made sure that they couldn't elect a guy like that again. But people will go out in the streets in Iran. Iran is savable. It really is. And I hope that's what some people are looking at. I don't trust this administration. But if we don't mess it up in the next 7 months and 9 days, I think Obama has a really tremendous chance for success. I do not think the people of Iran, I know the people of Iran do not want nuclear war. They don't even want nuclear weapons. They want to be treated with respect. And frankly, they want American culture, American DVDs. They don't hate America. They really don't. Most of them, frankly, are looking with fondness on the Shah, despite the fact that, hey, you know, we kept him in power and helped teach his army how to torture people. But honestly, compared to Khomeini and the mullahs that follow, a lot of them remember the Shah with affection. If you don't believe me, talk to a Persian American. Admittedly, the ones that come here tend to be more pro-American than the ones that stayed. I'll grant you that. But there is hope. There really is hope. So no, I'm not going to vote in the pool of whether we're going to attack Iran in the next 7 months and 9 days. I truly, truly hope we don't. But I also am not willing to concede either side. Not the neocon side that we need to attack, nor am I willing to concede the side of some on the left that it's not a problem. It is a problem. But I really feel that Obama can fix it. Now, maybe I'm putting all my hopes and dreams in Obama, and I'll grant you that. There is some of that. I don't know. I do like when he speaks. You know, it's fascinating. Obama is really being hailed all over the world. There's so many reasons for this, and a lot of it, frankly, has nothing to do with Barack Obama. Let's be fair. The world is tired of George Bush. The world is counting the 7 months and 9 days. The world wants an America that works with the world. And the fact that Barack Obama is half African-American, let's face it, really pleases the world. It shows that America is different. Only in America, they say. This could not happen in Europe. The minorities in Europe are far more mistreated than in America today, now that we're past Jim Crow. I just don't see a Muslim running France or Germany or England or Italy or any of those countries. Don't see it. Don't see it at all. Or any other African immigrant? No way. So young people are inspired by Obama. Der Spiegel, the German newspaper, called Obama a cross between John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The British, the French feel the same way. Africans, who never looked toward America for anything, are understandably bursting with pride. And this isn't even about Obama. It's about the symbol of Obama. It isn't about anything he's particularly said. But, you know, symbols are powerful things. In articles across Europe, across Asia, across Africa, and even across the Middle East, they are saying America has changed. This election in 2008 is not just about tax cuts and the war in Iraq and Obama's policies versus John McCain's policies. It is a chance to redeem America in the world, a chance to start getting us out from under the huge pit that George Bush dug us into. And if there's one thing I hope you can use to convince your fellow Americans who are considering voting for John McSame and John McBush, remind them that the world matters and that Obama can change America in the world. Hope you enjoyed today's show. This is Mark Levine, signing off.